I got very excited by Frank's talk, so have to see where that takes us.
Look at him being a sleazy.
So we can sort of just chill out with that for a little while, get in the mood. Yeah, there are some really nice Linux wallpapers I had to.
Yeah, there's some questionable ones too.
Well, I wouldn't say questionable, sketchy ones.
Sketchy.
That means questionable.
So, Eric,
yes.
Do you think you're ready?
I'm ready.
So we should.
Yeah, we can. We can bring in the audience, all three of them, and we will proceed.
Stay with PD and maybe a little bit extension to Maximus P. Thank you very much for the next talk, Eric.
Yeah, thank you. Couple of things. First of all, let me ask, I get a sense that this audience might be self-selected. Is there anybody here who has not used Pure Data? Is everybody in this room already familiar with PD and how it works? Yes, so I don't have to explain? Anything at all? Okay, good. I'll move right ahead to my exciting PowerPoint presentation. It's a sample accurate triggering system from PD and Max MSP. And it was occurring to me while I was listening to Frank's extremely interesting talk that at least potentially the two talks are quite complementary, although possibly reversed in terms of sophistication, because Frank is doing some extremely advanced use of Pure Data, and the actual use of the language that I'm going to be showing you is extremely basic and rudimentary. However, it is perhaps possible to observe that whereas Frank was focusing on the data aspect of Pure Data, I will be focusing on the purity aspect. And in particular, I'm going to be focusing on how to get very, very precise timing. I guess I would also, before leading Frank's talk, I found myself wondering with the term Grob, which I like very much, if it was chosen because it's Borg spelled backwards. Were you thinking about that? I thought that was very, very exciting and appropriate, since it does have the possibility to sort of suck all kinds of data into it. And the possibility of dealing with data in a very multi-dimensional way, and also graphically, as we'll see when we get to the end of this talk, might be something that potentially could get hooked up into the slightly more prototypical, or I should say prototype-like things that I'm going to be showing you. Okay, this work was motivated by the fact that I've used Max MSP and PD for various performances, and some of those performances require quite accurate timing because they involve the use of techno and techno-like things. And it's interesting to observe that very often in computer music, people sort of are a little afraid of rhythmic, very repetitive rhythmic structures, perhaps because they're afraid of writing music that they feel is not sufficiently sophisticated on the surface. However, some techno, I think, as we probably all know, is quite sophisticated, and I'm very interested to deal with some of those aspects. What's interesting is that when you attempt to do techno music in these languages, Max and PD, some of the limitations that you might not notice when you're doing more freeform algorithmic music do make themselves felt. So, I mean, I guess we could say, you know, the way we sometimes say, you know, something is good enough for jazz, which is a little bit insulting, not really accurate. We could say good enough for algorithmic music, but not good enough for techno. So what are some of the constraints that we're dealing with? And one other thing I'd like to point out, and this is, in the spirit of nonlinearity, is that as this is a Linux conference, the relationship between PD and Max MSP is also rather interesting because the languages are extremely similar. Both of them were originally written by Miller Puckett, and the reason Max was written first at Earcom, later given to David Ziccarelli, who commercialized it, and then PD was written later so that Miller could explore some slightly different aspects of computer music. But the languages themselves are extremely similar, not on the surface, but underneath. If you look at the code, there's a great deal of shared similarity. And from the standpoint of an audio developer, it's possible to write code that is either identical or close to identical that will run in both Max MSP and PD. And actually a project that's been around for quite a while is the Flexed T by Thomas Grill, which gives you a sort of a higher level interface for writing code that will work in both languages. So the reason it's interesting to think about these two languages is in the context of Linux and open source is that despite the fact that these languages are extremely similar, they are different in one very important respect, which is that Max MSP is a commercial program and it's closed source. And PD is a free program and it's open source. And so what that means is that although that's not the subject of this talk, it's quite possible and I think quite interesting to sort of look at how these programs are different. To sort of compare these two models. And one obvious way that they're different is Max MSP does not exist for Linux. It was just considered non-commercially viable. And so we could consider that as, with respect to the commercial world, somewhere between regrettable and a bug. So that's one of the downsides of the commercial aspect. The upside is that Max MSP is a lot prettier, at least on the surface. But anyhow, I thought I'd just sort of point that out. Now, what are the limitations in terms of timing? Well, Max MSP and PD both go back to an even earlier model of computer music that's often adopted, which is to make a distinction between audio information and control information. And at first, this distinction between audio versus control information was conceived of to save computer CPU cycles. In other words, if you had an envelope which was changing slowly, you would calculate a value for the envelope every, say, 1,000 seconds, every 1,000 samples or every 4,000 samples, and that way it would take less time for you to compute whatever you're going to compute. Now, in a real-time language, that concern remains. There are some operations that you do that you don't want to pull at every sample the position of a slider, for example, or a number box. So you have this distinction between events that are just checked every so often and that every so often is what's called a sample vector size. And then there are audio calculations that have to be ready or have to be done one sample at a time, because that's what DSP is all about. Okay, so we have that distinction between control information. Use this pointer here. Control information then is only accurate to within a sample vector, and a sample vector is just a block of samples that comes into a performance routine where you do your DSP. And any kind of event that happens within that will happen somewhere within that sample vector, but we don't know exactly where. And when that sample vector gets large enough, if that information should be timing critical, then things get a little wobbly. There are a couple of other differences I discovered with experimentation. MaxMSP has a flexible concept of time, which means that if you're fooling around with, it has a sample clock, which is inherently sample accurate, but it also has another timing system which is allowed to float. And the reason for that, as far as I can tell, is to make the audio portion of MaxMSP more robust, so that if you have to wait a little while for some user event to come through, they figured, 10 or 20 or 30 milliseconds, no biggie, nobody's going to notice. But meanwhile, at the same time, if you get a glitch in the audio, everybody's going to notice that. So it seems to me like a design trade-off. But what that means is that it's possible for a beat that is happening at the control level, which, for those of you who know MaxMSP, a metro object. Actually, I think there's a metro in PD too. So the metro object, it just sends out bangs, and so that's in the control level. That clock can permanently drift in MaxMSP. What I discovered is PD actually is a little bit more fastidious about its control clock. Its event clock is in fact subsample accurate. It's being measured in double floating point values. So PD doesn't drift in terms of its sense of when an event should take place, but the actual control event is variable to within a sample vector. And I thought I would just demonstrate this very quickly. First of all, with MaxMSP, I wanted to start out by listening to a Max metronome driven beat. Now, if you try to have a kick drum like this at a club, it might be a little embarrassing for people. Now I'm cheating a little bit here. I've set the same signal vector size to 4096, and I don't know offhand how many milliseconds that is, but it's a lot. Enough so that we feel that this is pretty wobbly. I can improve this by simply lowering the vector size. A typical signal vector size is 256 in MaxMSP. In PD, the default, I believe, is 64. Is that correct? So that's pretty good. A lot of people would be pretty happy with that. With this. Now, just to compare, this is a sample accurate clock. This is absolutely precisely sample accurate. I don't know if anybody can hear the difference. Let's see. We go back to 256. Let me know if you can tell the difference between sample accurate or max. It's pretty hard to tell. Max is pretty good once you get down to that level. So you might say, well, okay, what's the point of my talk? Maybe we should go now. Well, it turns out that even if a clock is good enough so that perceptually we feel that the beat is steady, there can be some other artifacts. And I'll observe that by mixing both together. Okay, so now right now, max is off, but what I'm going to do very quickly is just sync the two together. You hear what's happening? Now, let me go back to just max. We don't notice anything with max by itself, but we mix them together. And we're getting this flanging effect. So can anybody figure out what's happening? Well, I'll tell you. What? What's happening is the actual event is sort of sliding. It appears to be deterministic in the way that a pseudo random number is deterministic. In other words, that you don't know exactly what's going to happen, but it gets off. The beat gets off with itself. Now, to be fair to Max MSP, the clock itself, as it varies globally, which means that if we had two different events all being hit with the same bang, then they would all happen at the same time. Any irregularities would be propagated over the entire system. But the problem with this, as we heard, is that notice that I stopped and we got out of sync. I have to get back in sync. Now we're in sync, but let's say that I wanted to just open up a couple of windows, maybe create a couple objects. Notice that as I started doing. Putting a couple objects in, Max drift, the clock drifts off and it never comes back. This in fact does not happen with PD. So this is a Max specific problem. But anyhow, let's say that we're going down to like 64. Okay, the spectral effect is not as obvious, but can you still hear it? Getting better, but it's still there. It's still variable. You can really hear it now. What if we go down to signal vector size of 1? Now, finally, Max's performance is identical to sample after. However, I'd like to call your attention to the CPU load, which has become a little bit higher. Notice that right now we're using about 30% of what is admittedly a 2003 computer, so it's a little bit old. But if we go back to, let's say, 64, then it's only using 1 or 2. It's only using 1 or 2 percent of the CPU load. So in other words, the cost of forcing Max MSP to, and I presume the same thing is true of PD, forcing it to sample accuracy is just too high. So, incidentally, that's all the Max MSP for today. Getting back to here, one solution is to build metronomes at the sample level. So, what I plan to talk about for the rest of this talk is a number of externals that I've built. And I should also add that the Max MSP PD, the sort of wiring up language, it's one of those languages that has a possibility of annoying two different groups of people, because at one level, if you look at the graphical interface, even in Max MSP, which is a commercial product, it's kind of confusing and really not all that pretty compared to compared to, let's say, Logic or something like that, or Live that a lot of people might be familiar with. So some people may find it, overly complex. And at the same time, people who like to conceptualize and work with, purely at the text level, people like, Super Collider people may feel that it's just kind of awkward and silly that if you want 20 different sliders, that you have to like put them all in and connect them. In recent years, there, at least in Max MSP, there's been more programmatic elements. But it's worth pointing out that just by itself, the language by itself does leave a little bit to be desired on either side. Therefore, What I find extremely compelling about the MaxMSPD paradigm is the ability to combine what the language gives you, which is a comprehensive MIDI system, a lot of useful graphical interfaces, and basically dealing with all of the hardware issues. The ability to add your own signal processing through through C coding. I think that combination is very compelling. And for those of you who saw the demonstration on Faust the other day, maybe that's an even more compelling model, where there's a possibility, in theory, that you might be able to write an OOR DSP module that then could be compiled out to any kind of any other system, including MaxMSP and PD, that you might want. So that's where I think things are strong. And also as a historical point, when Miller Puckett first wrote Max, even before it was MaxMSP, he just assumed that there were very few primitives in the language, and he just assumed that anybody who wanted to do something musically interesting with Max would program in C. They'd have their own ideas about how to do things, and then they would just use the language to wire things up. And Miller was, in fact, quite surprised when he discovered that there were some people who didn't program in C, or maybe even couldn't program in C, who were doing some very interesting things just by combining the boxes. So that's one of those kind of interesting discoveries that people make. Okay, so on to my own externals. The primary external that I made is called SAMM, for Sample Accurate Multiple Metronome. And what it does is it basically calculates a clip. It calculates a metronome rounded to the sample level, because actually if you're calculating a metronome in double point precision floating point numbers, then you are actually more accurate than the sample itself. So what happens is it just sort of calculates the next sample that's closest to the actual time when the metronome could trigger, and the actual tempo is set as a parameter to the external. And when that happens, it puts a 1 into the sample vector at precisely the sample where an event should take place. So basically what's happening is rather than using bangs, which are a kind of variable attack, SAM uses clicks, uses click triggers. And that's the fundamental idea of this whole thing. And let me see if I can find an example of SAM for you. Okay, so now we're going to go into PD and see how that works out for us. Okay. Oh no, this is actually a demonstration that PD has the same variability as MaxMSP. We don't need to see that. You can trust me on that. I don't know what's going on here. But let's have a look over here. So what we're going to see is actually two externals. This is SAM over here. The first parameter is the tempo in attacks per minute, or BPM. And after that is the subdivision of the beat for a particular outlet. So in this case, this just has a metronome beating twice per second at BPM 120 with a single outlet. If I were to give it more parameters, let's say that I wanted to have the one is just a quarter note. Let's say that I wanted to have 16th notes. We divide by 4, and then I get another outlet. So that you have an arbitrary number of different metronomes, and the metronomes themselves are all synced. And further, if you wanted to sync SAM so that the sample starts at a particular moment and at a particular sample, and let's say synchronize that with other sounds, there's no reason you necessarily want to do that, but if you did, a click on the input to SAM will reset the clock to 0. So that means that you can just synchronize everything that you want. Under this is player, and player is a sample player that responds to clip triggers. In fact, it takes two values. It has in the left it takes a signal. Whenever it gets a click, that click is interpreted as the amplitude. So the clip not only starts the sound at a particular time, but we can use double. That number can have two functions, so it also tells you how loud it should be. And in the left in inlet, we give the transposition level of the sample, which of course can be negative as well as positive. If it's negative, then it goes backwards. Another point I would make about player is that it's polyphonic. Which means I think all of the built-in playing objects, both in MaxMSP and PD, are monophonic. Which means if you play a sample and then you get another instantiation, it'll stop the sample and then just go right back to the beginning. So you just get clicks all the time if you try to play long samples. Am I right about that? Yeah. So that's kind of annoying. I mean, everybody would say, well, don't be a crybaby. Just write a poly. Structure, and then you can solve your own problem. But I guess part of my philosophy is better computer music through laziness. And why, waste your time doing a poly object? And what happens if you do a poly object and it's like, only 10, and you realize you need like 16 or 20 or whatever? It's better to just put it into the external and forget about it. So if you get more attacks, then it will continue the attack it's playing. And then mix in the new one. Another nice example feature of player is that you have the option of either transposing everything, which is what's happening by default, or you can set the increment to be static so that the transposition level will be set once right at the onset of the note. The value of that is if you want to do polyphony within a player object, then you could have a lot of different instantiations of notes at different increments, and then you get that polyphony. So this then is sample accurate player. You can change the tempo. Simple but effective. Okay. Now I thought we would, since this is a Linux audio development thing, just take a quick look at what actually happens in SAM. Because, how many people have actually written MaxMSP or PD externals? Oh, okay. That's pretty good. How many could imagine doing so in the future that it might be fun? Okay, good. Well, just enough for me to spend a little bit of time on this. This is the perform loop. Basically, what happens is at every you have a sample vector filled with a certain number of samples, and every time that vector needs to be filled, this function gets called. I don't know. Maybe they call that a callback. Or something like that. The way it works out is that you have an object structure for your external that contains various kinds of useful things. This this thing X is the object itself. So that's the particular representation of the particular instance of a SAM. All of this is sent as an integer, an array of integer pointers, and as is kind of ironic, almost none of the data is actually integers. It's just using an array of integers as if they were pointers. So this is And it's good too, because Frank got us excited about how much we hate pointers, and hopefully I'll be able to increase the dismay. So X is the object itself, and then depending on the structure of your external, you'll have a number of different points to floating point arrays, and each array is a buffer that is the size of your sample vector. So let's say that your sample vector is 256. You're going to have a bunch of different arrays, and each one is going to have space for 256 floating point values. Now, this first array, the inlet, is just the input coming in. The reason that I need that inlet is because if I want to send a click in to synchronize the SAM, I need to have input. Otherwise, I could have totally ignored the input. And then after that, I do something that's a little bit fancy, which is that this N is actually the size of the DSP vector. Everything else, all the other pointers, I'm going to sort of grab inside of the code. The reason for that is because SAM has a variable number of outlets. When I write the code, I don't actually know how many outlets there are going to be, so I figure it out as we go through. Now, there's one other fine point that PD aficionados will appreciate, which is that when I mentioned that you'd have arrays of floating points for all the inputs and outputs, that's only partially true. In fact, PD does array memory sharing. To save a few kilobytes of memory, what PD will do is the input array and the output array will actually point to the same memory. Now, that's not a problem in the case of a large amount of DSP where you just go one sample at a time. Let's say you have a multiplier, so you take a sample, multiply it by a value, write it to output. Well, if the output vector is the same as the input vector, no big deal, because once you've processed that sample, you can throw it out. Unfortunately, some DSP requires that you don't mess up the input array. And for example, if the output array has some clicks put into it, when I deal with the first outlet, then I go and look at the second outlet, all of a sudden it's going to have a bunch of new clicks that actually weren't in it. So that's one of those fun little PD things that you discover only by tearing your hair out and banging against the wall and finally looking at the code to see what's going on. So what I do is I simply copy the input to another vector and I just use that instead. And that solves that problem. And then here I go through, for each metronome, I connect the beat to the pointer, and this is important. There's no guarantee that the input won't have garbage in it, so I just clean it out. Since these things are going to be putting out triggers as non-zero values, I want to make sure that everything in that array is zero except for where I put clip. And then finally, I look. This is the trigger. This is where this is the synchronizer. If the input is synchronized, then I reset the metronome. Otherwise, I just count down this metronome. So that's that minus one thing. But the metro is actually, did this go off? The metro itself is containing double floating point values, so that's why it's minus 1.0. And if the metronome goes down below zero, that means it's time to output a clip. So we just put a click in there, and then we add back the number of samples that it counts down. That guarantees that we stay subsample accurate. And then finally, this is just PD stuff that we don't have to worry about. Okay, so I thought that might be a little interesting to see. The next stage, now that we have absolutely rock steady clips, if we want to have better articulation, then I have another external called mask. And what mask will do is it will have a sequence of values that it will put out sequentially in response to clicks. So if we want to have, if you imagine, say 16 attacks within a drum machine pattern, if you have a typical say kick drum pattern like do 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 do, you would just go 1 0 0 1 0 0 1 0 0 0 1 0 0 0 1 0 1 0. So in other words, you can just type in the pattern that you want, and because these values are articulated as amplitudes, they don't have to be ones. They could be anything you want, which means that you can deal more subtly with amplitude than is necessarily possible with all drum machines. So let's have a look then at what you can do with mask. I'll go very quickly just to show you that that in SAM it's possible to have different kinds of specifications. And let's see, I think I have to reload this thing. Let's see if that was successful. I think I may have to quit and start again. There's sometimes when the arrays will conflict with each other and get confused. So this has 3 against 5, but we have alternate tempo specifications. So we can specify in terms of divisions of the beat. If we know the number of samples that we want the duration to be, we can just specify beat directly in samples, in milliseconds, or in a kind of a weird way, you can talk about the ratios between the beats. So 7/16 means 7/16 divisions of a whole note, or 3. So just very quickly, I wanted to show you that all works. Now getting to the mask, here we have some mask patterns, and what I'm going to do, I'm using two masks, one mask to control the rhythm and one to control the transposition of player. So. So here you can see, this is the rhythm. And we have a similar mask for transposition that only transposes down whatever that interval is on the last attack. So you can see that, and I think we have some additional patterns. So you can store as many patterns as you want. This just has these two patterns. And I can move back and forth between any pattern I want. And I have a choice of keeping the patterns locked in phase or not. So mask is actually a pretty useful thing. And there's no rule that says all the masks have to be the same length, which means that it's quite possible to have different masks controlling different parameters of sound, all going at different periodicities, creating interesting kind of polyrhythms. And I'll show you an example. This may be a little small. Can people read this? Okay. So basically, what this is doing is it's dividing the beat in 2, which creates an 8th note, and dividing it in 16, since it's creating a 16th note, and then using sends to send those different places. We have player with a hi-hat, but that is actually going to be ring-modulated by an oscillator, and the oscillator is going to be going in a periodicity of 5/16th notes. 5/16ths just goes through these different values. Now, I created a sort of utility external called click hole, because osc needs to have a constant value for its frequency. If I give it, say, 350 for 1 second, for one sample, and 0 all the rest, you're basically going to get nothing. You'll just get a click. So click hold is basically a sample and hold unit. There is a sample and hold unit in PD, but I didn't like the way it worked. So here's the actual attack pattern. It's a pattern of four sixteenths. And the hi-hat transposition is going in a cycle of three. So we have a cycle of three against a cycle of four against a cycle of five. So that's the hi-hat. The static increment, by the way, is set so that each attack of the hi-hat will continue at whatever increment we get. So you can hear these cycles going through just in the hi-hat. And then, of course, you can do the club thing where you gate the bass up. So that's basically only two values. I think I had a slightly different version of this where I kind of broke things up into different. The same thing here with the bass drum. I actually had let's see. Some feedback going on. So the bass drum is being comb filtered in this comb over subpatch, and I'll observe this is an interesting thing about a very nice feature about PD is that you can decide what the vector size will be inside of each patch, and I set the block size here with this block to four. Because with comb filters, where you have combs of very short amounts of time, you also need, because I'm using this delay read, delay write thing in PD, you also need to have a very small vector size. I took it down to four, or sometime you might want to even take it down to one. But so you have basically this whole thing being distorted and comb filtered and you can choose other patterns. So you have a lot of variability in how you actually articulate what goes on in the DSP of your drum machine. And I think that one of the most interesting things with, let's see here. Oh, freaking PD out of there, no problem. One of the most interesting things in drum machines is to be able to just integrate DSP signal processing into whatever pattern you want, and that's where I think PD and MaxMSP are really excellent environments for doing this kind of thing. Now, so far I showed you sample accurate playback of a sample, but it's equally possible to do sample accurate playback of a of a synthesizer, and what I've got going on here, let's see. Okay, let's get that. We've got some echoes in the picture. I have here. This is actually getting a little quiet for my taste. So this sequencer here is just setting a different pattern, a different frequency for each step. So I can just sort of play around with this thing. Or, if I'm lazy, I can just randomly set these things. Or I can set them. What's happening here, I'll stop this very briefly, is that I'm just creating a new mass, putting it into this mass value, and then I'm using it to drive a bunch of oscillators. This oscill happens to be my own external. It's useful for playing different favorite waveforms that we all know and love. So we, at one level, we just have all the frequencies of these oscillators changing. At another level, I have an ADSR, another of my own externals. This ADSR is click driven. So what that means is I'm just sending the click signal into the inlet. It's going through this mask, and the mask is then just hitting it with this sequence of amplitudes. And then that ADSR envelope is multiplied by the output. So then that's how we get this whole thing. And then of course, not necessarily you want to put some point out is that, and this I talk about a little bit later in the paper, is that the all of these click signals can also interoperate perfectly well with objects that work at the event level. There, you have the penalty that you pay for doing that is that you remain only as accurate as what the sample vector is. But as an example, I have this utility thing, click to bang. And what it does is it takes a clip and it just turns, sends a bang. So this whole thing here means that I could automatically change, if I have a set, I can just automatically change the pattern at each iteration. Notice of the bar. Notice also that this temporal value is a fractional value. So that means that we're actually taking four beats. That trigger will click once every four beats at metronome 120. So you see that now we're getting this thing changing every so often. And we can use different envelopes. We can try a software envelope. Things that you can do with analog synths, or should I say, virtual analog synthesizers. So I thought that would be useful to show how that works out. So that is most of the development that I wanted to talk about. All of those externals seem to work pretty well. Getting back here. We talked a little bit about interoperating control things. We showed how to make a drum machine. However, there's a more recent kind of experimental external I've been working on that's called DMAC for drum machine. And the way DMAC works is that you basically, rather than having all of these different mask objects sort of scattered everywhere that represent the drum pattern, DMAC has you just dump all that information in terms of data. You use a store message, and this is the format you use. I want to point out first of all that although having to specify all of this is kind of hideous. This is an extremely flexible way to represent attack patterns. So the first thing is you tell the pattern number, because you can store as many patterns as you may care to program in. And then the beat duration. Beat duration is basically how many quarter notes in a bar. So if you have a 4-4 bar, you would say 4. If you have a 3-4 bar, you would say 3. If you had a 7-8 bar, everybody know what a 7-8 bar is, 7-8 notes, then you would say 3.5. So what that implies is that the duration can be any floating point value, which I think is kind of nice, because a lot of drum machines tend to sort of quantize you to integers. This doesn't do that. Okay, so next you get a slot number, because there are going to be a number of completely integrated pairs of attacks and increments. They're all going to be gathered together. And each slot number can have an individual number of segments. The reason for that is because, okay, if you're just doing 16th notes, a string of 16th notes, then the mask way makes the most sense. You just divide the beat duration to 16. But what happens if you want to have, say, a quintuplet figure on the first beat, then the next two beats divided into 7, and then the last divided into 3? Well, the way this works is you say, okay, we're going to take a beat duration of 1, divide that into 7, make your pattern for that, then a beat duration of 2, divide that into 5, or whatever. And so what that means is that you have arbitrary subdivisions of the interior of the beat. So even though this is definitely good for thumping nosebleed techno, where you just have a bass drum on every quarter note, you can specify really any quantized rhythm. I mean, this is really not very good for rubato, but you can do that by changing the tempo, and that will control all this stuff. Then finally, you get an attack list and increment list. So as an example of that, and I think that probably looks fairly horrible. First of all, is there anybody here? Well, let me put it this way. How many people here can read music? I'm delighted to see that not everybody raised their hands, because we've really gotten to the point where literacy and common practice notation is kind of optional for doing computer music. This pattern here is sort of showing why it's a good idea to be able to break these things up into segments. So this is, I'm putting the snare into this this first pattern here. Actually no, the bass drum is going into the first slot and the snare into the second. So look at the snare first. We have a triplet dividing one beat. So that's over here. We say slot number one beat divided into 3, and here's the pattern. Attack, rest, attack. And then here's the increment pattern, which, because they're only attacks, they're only 2 increments. Incidentally, if you get any of this data wrong, DMAC will crash gloriously. I mean, there's no error checking at all. Which is why this is not the right way to input data. This is possibly an okay way to conceptualize it, but I'm thinking that you might want to have a really good front end, and that's where the relevance of Frank's talk comes in. Because looking at the way he's organizing the graphics, it seems like it's at least potentially possible that you could do something with that pointer graphic system that might map well to here, and in fact might go well beyond the complexity of what is possible with a very lame program called Sibelius. We've got this division to 3, division to 7. Okay, we're dividing 2 beats into 7, there's the attack pattern, and then finally we're dividing 1 beat into 8, that's this. Now, here I'm going to point out a conceptual shortcoming of the way I'm dealing with things. I think it could be done better. We have a quintuplet figure, but the last 2 beats of the quintuplet are divided into 3. Now, how many people are familiar with Stockhausen's Klavierstück? One person, okay. So there's almost as many people who are familiar with Stockhausen's Klavierstück as who cannot read music, which I think is actually kind of a nice balance. You get these subdivisions of subdivisions of subdivisions. I kind of cheat here. I use the lowest common denominator, 15, and that's how I articulate this pattern. You can see that the triplets are done in this kind of hemiola way here. And you can do any conceivable rhythm that way. I mean, you just calculate what the lowest common denominator is, and you go with that. But it could be argued that it would be more elegant if I could have an arbitrary level of recursion in case anybody wants to program one of Stockhausen's piano pieces into my drum machine. So there, that's that. What does that look like in PD? Looks something like this. And we have to store this. See if this actually works. I know we're getting close to time, but we started a little late, so I hopefully we can end a little late. We've got this sample here, and for some reason, I'm not hearing this. Oh, no. I think I may have one of those quit and start again kind of things. But let's do that really quickly. Okay. I've got my samples here. Load this thing up. Okay, so just remind yourself of what that clip was for. I put a little bit of variability on the increments to get further articulation. But there you go. If you want to have a bar that has that kind of rhythm, or pretty much anything else you feel like, then you can do it. And I think that maybe I have one or two other things to show. This is a slightly more integrated drum machine that has a bass line integrated into it and some other things. Back and resonance. So you can have some fun, you can really start to build some useful tools that you might actually use in club. And you can go back and forth selecting different patterns. And so forth. And I may have to quit. To bring up the last one. And I'll just show in concluding that I have started to work with different ways of inputting patterns. So, for example, let's see here. Rather than build up the patterns wholesale, I created a couple of other messages. So this slot amps thing allows you to just add in an attack cycle for a given slot. So you could build up a pattern by, let's say, putting in the pattern for the bass drum, and then the snare drum, and then whatever else you might have lying around. And that gets to more of the kind of the traditional way that you build drum patterns. This does also have a slot increment thing, which by default the slot amps will initialize every attack to an increment of one, but then you can go ahead and change the increments to be whatever you want. And again, you can imagine that with some kind of a graphic interface, this could be a kind of useful thing. And I actually don't know if how many of these patterns actually got loaded, but let's give it a try. Okay, so we've got a couple of these patterns here. And so you can loop various sequences and just like a drum machine. You can just program in anything you want, play around with it. You can play sequences and or do whatever you want. So this whole thing is, I would say, on the way to being functional. It's not quite there yet. Of course, it's obligatory to say that, in a developers conference. It's not quite there. But actually, I have used this DMAC external in performance and with people in the audience, and it didn't crash. So at least it has potential. So I think I should stop there, and if we have time for questions, I'd be happy to do it. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much, Eric, for this great talk. Unless there is a very urgent question, I would like to skip the section and so you can always privately, of
Absolutely.
Course, answer the questions. And so we make a 10 minutes intermission and continue afterwards with Victor Lazzarini. Thank you very much again.
You're welcome.
Oh, no problem. But I guess it's just for What? What's that?
Well, onset detection is a very different matter, but.